You've probably walked past, I don't know, 100 invisible giants today without even realizing
Oh,
it.
easily. Probably more.
Right. I mean, think about your morning. You leave your apartment, you push open that heavy glass door at your local coffee shop, you badge into your office building. Maybe you walk past a stairwell and hit the panic bar on an emergency exit.
Yeah, you're constantly interacting with all this physical infrastructure.
Exactly. You touch it, you
Yeah.
completely rely on it, your actual safety depends on it, and yet you never really look down at the metal you're holding.
Oh, you just expect it to work.
You just expect it to work. But somebody actually made that metal,
Yeah.
and somebody is, quite frankly, quietly printing an absolute fortune from it, just hiding right in plain sight.
It really is the ultimate blind spot in how we view the modern world, I think. We spend all our time obsessing over the glowing screens in our pockets, right?
Right.
Completely captivated by software and digital platforms.
100%.
Meanwhile, we entirely ignore this physical, tactile infrastructure that actually allows a commercial building to, function safely. And because that metal hardware is invisible to our conscious minds, we just make assumptions about it.
We just assume it's basic.
Right. We assume it's a simple product, we assume it's cheap to make, and we assume it's a terrible, commoditized business to be in.
And that assumption right there is exactly why we are here today. Welcome to today's deep dive. Our mission today is to analyze this fascinating independent equity research report from Factors Today. It's dated June 29th, 2026.
Yeah, and the subject of this report is a company called Allegion, ticker symbol ALLE.
Okay, so let's just unpack this right up front. Allegion is a pure-play manufacturer of security hardware. They are entirely focused on what goes around the door. So we're talking about mechanical locks, electronic access controls, and those heavy panic devices on emergency exits.
Basically, if it's on a commercial door, they probably made it.
Right. And you listening, you might not immediately recognize the corporate name Allegion, but if you actually look at your keys right now, you definitely know their brands. Schlage, Von Duprin, LCN.
Those are everywhere. And the central paradox we are examining today, based on this research, is arguably one of the most, compelling and confusing setups in the entire financial market right now.
That's wild.
It really is. Because by almost every single empirical measure that actually matters, Allegion is a ridiculously high quality, high margin business protected by this massive competitive moat.
Yeah.
Yet it is currently trading at its cheapest valuation multiple in a decade. The market is effectively pricing this elite company as if it were just a generic cyclical commodity business that's about to, fall completely off a cliff.
Which is just wild to me. It begs the question, right? Has the stock market completely lost its mind and just handed you, the investor, this hidden gem on a silver platter?
Or is it a trend?
Exactly. Or is this a classic value trap? Like a situation where a stock looks super cheap on a screen, but is actually a sinking ship with systemic problems.
Yeah.
So to understand why the market is treating this company so poorly right now, we can't just look at the stock chart.
No, definitely not.
We first have to understand why the underlying business is actually phenomenal. So what exactly are these invisible giants of the doorframe doing every day?
Well, what's fascinating here is that Allegion doesn't just sell locks, they sell the entire integrated ecosystem of the door opening.
Okay.
If we look at the hard data from the report, their 2025 revenue was roughly $4.1 billion.
Wow, okay.
Right, it's big. But the composition of that revenue tells a very specific story. It breaks down into three distinct categories. The lion's share, about 67%, comes from mechanical products.
That's the heavy metal.
Exactly. Mechanical locks, hydraulic door controls, exit devices. Then you have another 26% coming from electronic products. That's the faster growing digital access control segment. So think badge readers and smart locks.
Got it. And the rest.
The last 7% or so comes from software and services wrapped around those products.
Okay, so if I'm doing the math there, basically two-thirds of their entire multi-billion dollar business is just casting and bending metal.
Essentially, yes.
In the year 2026, that feels incredibly old school. You would think a metal bending business would be highly cyclical, meaning people only buy that stuff when times are good and they have extra cash to build new offices.
You'd think so, yeah.
But there is a massive catch here that changes the entire dynamic. These are not discretionary purchases, are they?
Not at all. And this is the key. The vast majority of what Allegion sells, particularly in the commercial real estate space, falls strictly under the category of life safety equipment.
Life safety.
Yeah. Think about a sprawling hospital complex, or a crowded elementary school, or a 50-story commercial office tower. As a building owner, you legally cannot operate that facility if your fire doors and emergency exits do not have compliant certified hardware installed.
Right. It's literally written into the municipal law.
Exactly. It's written into the building code. If a fire breaks out, that mechanical exit device, you know, the panic bar, it has to work flawlessly, allowing hundreds of terrified people to escape every single time.
Which creates a total floor for demand.
Right. It creates a non-discretionary, regulatory-mandated demand floor. You can't just decide to skip buying it to save a few bucks this quarter.
And the history embedded in these brands really puts that life safety aspect into perspective. I mean, the report points out that Von Duprin literally invented the exit device.
Right, in 1908.
Yeah, 1908, that heavy push bar you see on every single emergency door. And Schlage, they invented the cylindrical push-button lock back in the 1920s. They've been doing this for over a century.
They practically invented the category.
I always like to think of this hardware as basically the plumbing of a commercial building.
Yeah.
You only ever think about it if it breaks and totally ruins your day, but the building code says you absolutely must have it installed to even get your occupancy permit.
And to take that a step further, because it is a critical life safety item, the barrier to entry for a competitor isn't just, you know, knowing how to pour liquid metal into a
Yeah.
mold. The real barrier is passing incredibly rigorous per SKU certifications from independent groups.
Like Underwriters Laboratories, right? UL.
Exactly. UL and the Builders Hardware Manufacturers Association. You have to submit your hardware to extreme physical testing. We're talking fire testing, cycle testing, just to prove it won't fail when human lives are actually on the line.
But let me push back a little here on behalf of the listener. Because I hear you on the certifications and I hear you on the century of brand history.
Okay, sure.
But at the end of the day, isn't a metal lock basically a commodity now? I mean, we live in a massive globalized world. Anyone with a decent factory overseas can cast metal.
True.
Why can't a cheaper international competitor just swoop in, hire some smart engineers to pass those UL tests, and massively undercut Allegion on price?
That is exactly the logical question to ask, and it acts as the perfect bridge into understanding the industry structure. The reason a metal lock isn't just a commodity is because of how Allegion has constructed one of the most impenetrable competitive moats in the entire industrial sector.
A moat out of metal locks.
Right. The report actually references the Greenwald taxonomy of competitive advantage here. Applying that framework, Allegion's moat relies on three massive structural pillars:
Okay, let's hear them.
specification lock-in, the installed base aftermarket annuity, and local economies of scale.
Okay, I want to break those down one by one. And let's definitely start with specification lock-in, because when I read how this actually works in the sources, my jaw kind of dropped.
It is an incredibly brilliant mechanism. Consider the life cycle of a new commercial building. Long before a shovel ever even hits the dirt, architects and independent security consultants are drafting the blueprints.
Right, the early design phase.
During that phase, they write the specifications for every single component of the building. But they don't just say, put a panic bar here. They will literally write the specific brand and model, like Von Duprin 9899 series exit device, directly into the master plan.
They name drop the exact part before the building even exists.
Exactly. Once that specific part is specified, that early in the design process, it flows downhill to everyone else. The general contractor bidding on the job, the local hardware distributor, the locksmith installing it.
So they are totally baked into the DNA of the
Yep.
building. But okay, what stops the general contractor from looking at that blueprint, seeing the Von Duprin, and saying, you know what, I can buy a generic brand from overseas for half the price and just pocket the difference?
The immense friction of making a change. To switch to a cheaper, non-specified brand mid-project means the contractor has to submit a formal request to respecify the door opening.
Oh.
Yeah, and they have to recertify the fire rating for that specific combination of door and hardware. They have to change the physical templating, like the drilled holes on the door itself, and they have to retrain the local installers on a completely new product.
Okay, so the labor cost and the delay totally wipe out whatever tiny amount they saved on the cheaper metal.
Precisely. Why would a general contractor risk delaying a $500 million office tower project or take on a massive life safety liability just to save, what, a few hundred dollars on a door handle?
They wouldn't. It makes no sense.
They won't do it. The risk to reward is entirely broken. They simply default to the trusted, certified brand that the architect already wrote down. And there is a subtle but incredibly powerful detail the report highlights here.
What's that?
Allegion executives actually sit on the standards bodies that write the building codes.
Wait, hold on.
Yeah.
They literally help write the laws that force building managers to buy their specific type of products.
They are physically at the table helping to draft the very life safety rules that their own products are conveniently, perfectly designed to meet.
That is incredible. It's basically a form of soft regulatory capture. I mean, no wonder the moat is so deep. Okay, so pillar one is that they get baked into the blueprints early. What is the second pillar? The aftermarket annuity.
This is the replacement loop. And it is where the real cash is generated over time. Once a building is outfitted with Schlage locks or Von Duprin exit devices on day one, that building manager is essentially captured as a customer for decades.
Because things break.
Exactly. If an exit bar breaks 10 years down the line because students have been slamming into it every day, the maintenance team doesn't shop around for a cheaper alternative online.
Right. They just want to swap it out fast.
They order the exact same Von Duprin model so it perfectly aligns with the existing holes and mounting plates already drilled into the heavy metal door.
Ugh, I see.
Or consider a massive university campus. If they build a new dormitory and need to expand their master key system, they are forced to buy more Schlage locks so that the campus security master keys continue to work across the whole facility. It creates this automatic one-for-one replacement cycle.
They get you on the new build, and they basically keep you for life on the maintenance. It's a recurring revenue stream, but dressed up as an industrial product.
Exactly.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. The third pillar, which is local economies of scale. The sources highlight a massive structural contrast in how the door hardware market actually works globally versus locally.
It's a huge difference.
Right. If you look at the global market, it's highly fragmented. Thousands of little regional companies everywhere. But if you zoom in strictly on the U.S. non-residential market, it is a tight, consolidated oligopoly. It is basically just Allegion and their main rival, Assa Abloy, dominating the entire commercial space.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture of competitive strategy, it proves a fundamental law. Dense local dominance is far more powerful and profitable than sprawling, fragmented global scale. Allegion has spent a century building the absolute densest network of commercial distributors, locksmiths, and architectural specifiers inside the United States.
And their manufacturing is close by, right?
Right. They support that U.S. network with a massive, highly efficient manufacturing footprint located just across the border in Mexico. Mm-hmm. They don't need to win everywhere in the world. They just need to utterly dominate the specific, highly lucrative local ecosystem.
But, you know, we both know that having a great theoretical story about a moat doesn't automatically make a stock a good investment.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of companies have great historical narrative.
Yeah, absolutely.
If this moat is real, like if they truly have pricing power, customer lock-in, and regulatory capture, then those dynamics must show up in the financial fingerprint of the company.
Yeah.
The numbers should be screaming at us.
And I can assure you, the numbers laid out in the Factors Today report do exactly that. They are, frankly, jaw-dropping for a company that fundamentally just bends metal.
Let's hear them.
In fiscal year 2025, Allegion posted a 45.2% gross margin.
Wow.
Their operating margin was a massive 21.1%. And most importantly, their return on invested capital, or ROIC, hovered right around 19%.
Okay, let's just pause and unpack that gross margin for a second, because I want to make sure everyone listening realizes how absurd that is.
It's huge.
A 45.2% gross margin means for every $100 of door hardware they sell, it only costs them about $55 in raw materials and direct factory labor to actually make the thing.
Right.
That leaves a massive, almost software-like cushion of profit on heavy industrial goods. But the real test is how that compares to their competition, right?
Exactly. And this is where that local scale advantage truly reveals itself in the math. Let's look at Assa Abloy, their primary competitor.
The giant one.
Yeah, Assa Abloy is the global number one player in this space. They are roughly 2 to 3 times larger than Allegion by total global revenue.
Okay.
Yet, despite being 3 times bigger, Assa Abloy only manages a 15.5% operating margin, and their ROIC is stuck around 10%.
Okay, that is wild. Allegion is the significantly smaller player overall, but they are beating the massive global giant by roughly 6 full margin points.
Yes. And structurally, a smaller player out-earning a massive global rival is the ultimate empirical signature that a localized competitive advantage is far superior to global scale.
That makes sense.
ASSA ABLOY is spread thin across dozens of countries, dealing with different building codes and fragmented distribution networks everywhere they go. Allegion, conversely, is hyper-concentrated in the absolute richest, most profitable niche on the planet, the U.S. commercial non-residential hardware market.
It's literally like a local independent coffee shop radically outprofiting a massive global Starbucks location right across the street, simply because the local shop somehow secured a 50-year lease on the absolute best, highest foot traffic corner in the city.
Exactly.
The local shop doesn't need 10,000 global locations. They just need to own the single most lucrative spot.
That captures the dynamic perfectly. But, before we move off the financials, there is a crucial data nuance in the report that we really need to clarify for any listeners who like to run their own stock screens.
Oh, right, the ROE thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
If you pull up Allegion on a standard financial website right now, you will likely see a return on equity or ROE metric sitting at nearly 32%. The research report explicitly warns that you must entirely ignore that number.
I noticed that in the notes, and I have to ask for an ELI5 here. Explain it like I'm five. Why are we ignoring ROE and looking almost exclusively at ROIC? I always thought return on equity was basically the gold standard for measuring a company's profitability.
In many cases, ROE is a fantastic metric. But for Allegion, the math behind ROE has become entirely distorted.
How so?
Well, return on equity is calculated by dividing net income by shareholders' equity. But over the last decade, Allegion has aggressively used its cash to buy back its own stock on the open market.
Okay, which shrinks equity?
Right. And they have also made numerous acquisitions that loaded their balance sheet with intangible assets and goodwill. These aggressive financial maneuvers have mathematically driven their tangible common equity into negative territory.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so when the denominator of the ROE equation, the equity is artificially shrunk or turns negative, the resulting percentage just skyrockets into total meaninglessness.
Ah, okay. So it looks like they are generating infinite returns on equity, but it's really just a quirk of the accounting.
Correct. That is exactly why the report focuses on return on invested capital, or ROIC. ROIC measures the actual cash profit generated against all the real hard capital deployed in the business, both debt and equity. At roughly 19%, Allegion is earning returns that are more than double their underlying cost of acquiring capital.
Which is fantastic.
That is elite compounding territory.
So we have a company with a century-old moat, massive margins, dominating a local oligopoly, and earning 19% of the capital it deploys. If the overarching financials are this bulletproof, why has this stock been essentially dead money for 5 years?
That's the billion-dollar question.
Seriously, if you bought this stock in 2021, you've barely made a dime.
Okay.
To answer that, the sources tell us we have to tear that beautiful 21% blended operating margin apart. We have to look under the hood. Because Allegion isn't really one unified, happy company. It is a tale of two wildly different businesses living under one roof.
The segment asymmetry is genuinely staggering when you actually break it down. Let's look at the two halves.
Yeah, lay it out.
In fiscal 2025, the Allegion Americas segment, which is that U.S. commercial business we've just been praising, generated $3.2 billion in revenue. That represents 79% of the total company revenue.
Okay, almost 80%.
But remarkably, it generated 92% of the total operating profit, and it did that at a staggering 27.9% operating margin.
The Americas segment is basically the golden goose. It is carrying the entire company on its back. Now contrast that with the Allegion International segment, which is predominantly their operations across Europe.
It's a completely different story.
That segment generated 21% of the total revenue, but it only contributed a pathetic 8% of the total profit, operating at a meager 9.2% margin. You had the Americas running at nearly 28% and International gasping for air at 9%.
This extreme divergence raises a really critical question about how investors should value the consolidated business. The research argues that slapping a single valuation multiple on the blended overall numbers is a fundamental mistake.
You can't just average them out.
Exactly. To truly value Allegion, you have to value the incredibly lucrative U.S. commercial franchise as a premium compounder and then apply a severe haircut or discount to the international side of the business.
But the report highlights something even worse than just structurally low margins in Europe.
Ah.
Look at the capital flow.
Yeah, this is where it gets scary.
There is a terrifying detail buried in the 2025 data regarding how management is actually spending money. In that single fiscal year, the assets sitting in the international segment ballooned by $740 million.
They just poured money in.
They poured $750 million of asset weight into Europe. And what was the return on that massive investment? Operating income in that segment only rose by $10.2 million.
The contrast in capital efficiency is brutal. To put a metric on it, the pre-tax return on assets for the Americas segment sits at a phenomenal 33%. They are highly efficient at turning American assets into cash.
Right.
But the return on assets for the international segment is a dismal 4%.
Okay, I have to challenge this logically. If I'm the CEO and I have a golden goose in the United States printing 28% margins and a 33% return on assets, why on earth am I pouring almost $1 billion into European assets that are yielding 4%?
It's baffling at first glance.
It defies common sense.
Yeah.
Is management just empire building at the direct expense of the shareholders?
On the surface, it absolutely looks like value destruction. But if we dig deeper into management's rationale for this seemingly bizarre capital allocation, we find it is driven by an existential fear.
What are they afraid of?
They are staring down a massive secular shift in the security industry, the rapid rise of electronics and digital access control.
The smart lock revolution, getting rid of physical keys altogether.
Yes. Management's overarching strategy is to take the massive, reliable cash flows generated by their traditional mechanical hardware, the metal locks in the Americas, and aggressively redeploy that cash to build out a comprehensive electronic access control platform. And they haven't been shy about it. They went on a $1.7 billion mergers and acquisitions spree to try and basically buy their way into this digital future.
Let's track that M&A spree because it is extensive. In 2022, they spent over $900 million to acquire Stanley Access Technologies, primarily to get a foothold in automatic doors.
Right.
Then, in 2025, they went on an absolute tear, closing 9 different acquisitions in a single year. The anchor of that 2025 spree was a company called Elotech, a German manufacturer of RFID readers, you know, those little black boxes you tap your badge against.
Yep.
They bought Elotech for roughly $387 million. And they kept the checkbook open into 2026, acquiring a West Coast door company called DCI. They're actively buying revenue growth and technology.
But we have to carefully parse the dual nature of this electronic threat because it impacts their business model entirely differently depending on which market segment we are actually looking at. Well, in the residential space, so think about the front door of your house or apartment, electronics represent a massive disruptive threat. Mechanical residential locks are rapidly becoming commoditized. Furthermore, big tech companies like Amazon and Apple, leveraging their digital wallets and smart home ecosystems, possess real power to dictate terms in that market.
Right. They own the ecosystem.
It is a highly competitive, lower margin knife fight for the residential front door.
Right, because if I can unlock my front door with my Apple Watch or an app on my phone, I honestly don't care if the deadbolt itself was made by Schlage or some generic brand. The brand value completely shifts from the metal lock to the software ecosystem.
You're touching on the exact risk. The metal becomes dumb hardware, but in the commercial space, so the hospitals, schools, and offices, the dynamic completely flips. In commercial real estate, the shift to electronics is actually a structural tailwind for Allegion. Because returning to our discussion of building codes, even if a hospital installs a state-of-the-art biometric digital badge reader on a door, the law dictates they still absolutely must have a certified mechanical lock and panic bar on that fire door.
Oh, right. The physical fail-safe.
The digital component doesn't replace the mechanical life safety component. It gets layered right on top of it. Allegion's strategic goal with all this M&A is to own both the digital RFID reader on the wall and the mechanical lock in the door, capturing the entire profit pool of the opening.
That makes strategic sense, but at what cost to the balance sheet?
Right.
Let's look at the financial impact of this $1.7 billion M&A spree. The Factors Today report notes a highly concerning metric. Goodwill and intangible assets now make up a staggering 52% of Allegion's total assets.
That's a huge portion.
Let me just pause and explain that for you listening. When a company buys another company, they often pay a premium over the actual physical value of the desks, factories, and inventory they are acquiring.
Yeah.
That premium, the extra money paid for the brand name, the customer list, or the tech, is recorded on the balance sheet as an accounting concept called goodwill.
And having 52% of your entire asset base tied up in goodwill and intangibles is a massive watch item for any serious investor.
Massive.
When over half your assets are essentially just the premium you paid for other businesses, you are incredibly exposed to impairment write-downs if those acquisitions fail to perform as projected. The debate in the market right now is whether Allegion is executing a highly disciplined strategy to build a necessary tech platform, or if this is a dangerous case of roll-up drift.
Roll-up drift.
Yeah, a scenario where a maturing company blindly buys top-line revenue to mask the fact that their core organic business is actually slowing down.
I have a real mathematical problem with their 2025 spree specifically. The research shows that on those 9 deals, Allegion paid an incredible 104% of the purchase price in goodwill and intangibles.
That's just wild math.
To put that in plain English, they acquired almost zero hard physical assets. They were purely buying software code, intellectual property, and customer relationships. They are paying a massive premium multiple to play catch up in the software space.
Yeah.
Doesn't that structurally dilute that beautiful 45% gross margin we were praising earlier?
It absolutely threatens it.
I mean, software businesses are wonderful, but buying into them at peak market multiples when your core competency is bending metal in Mexico, that seems inherently risky.
The margin dilution is a highly valid concern, and it is exactly what the bearish investors are pointing to right now. But we don't have to guess about the risks of trying to rapidly digest 9 different tech and international companies in a single year.
No, we don't.
The risks are not theoretical anymore. They actually blew up in management's face in the very most recent quarter, triggering a massive sell-off in the stock.
Which brings us to the Q1 2026 stumble. Let's set the scene here. It's April 28, 2026. The Q1 earnings print hits the wire, and the market reaction is just violent. The stock drops 7.1% in a single day of trading.
People were scrambling.
Walk us through exactly what happened in that quarter.
It was a shock to the system because it was the first time in years that Allegion reported a decline in their adjusted earnings per share. EPS dropped by 3.2% year over year.
Okay, not great.
Now, the Americas segment actually held up decently on top-line revenue, though they did experience some margin compression. But the real disaster, the thing that totally spooked the market, occurred in the international segment. Organic revenue in Europe plummeted by 5.3%, and the segment margin compressed by a brutal 220 basis points.
Let's do a quick definition check. When you say 220 basis points, you mean 2.2%.
Exactly. In the financial world, 100 basis points equals 1%.
So their profit margin in Europe shrank by over 2 full percentage points. But a 5% drop in revenue in a single quarter is a massive red flag. Was underlying demand in Europe suddenly just falling off a cliff?
No, the demand was there, and that is what makes this so fascinating. The wound was entirely self-inflicted by management. On the earnings call, they admitted that they botched a major software upgrade at one of their legacy European mechanical manufacturing plants.
Oh, no.
Specifically, they failed at implementing a new ERP system, an enterprise resource planning platform.
I want to understand the physical mechanics of this.
Yeah.
How does a piece of software literally stop a massive factory from bending metal and shipping locks?
Well, an ERP system is essentially the digital brain of a modern manufacturing facility. It tracks the raw steel coming into the loading dock. It routes the instructions to the machines on the factory floor, manages the inventory in the warehouse, and prints the shipping manifests for the trucks. When the ERP implementation failed, the digital brain disconnected from the physical factory. The factory workers physically had the steel, and they had the customer orders, but the computer system couldn't generate the bill of materials or process the shipping labels.
Wow. So they were just stuck.
The entire production line ground to a halt. They essentially bricked their own factory. They had a massive backlog of orders they simply couldn't physically ship, which directly led to the 5% revenue drop.
Ouch. You spent all this money trying to modernize your technology, and you end up shutting down your own factory floor. That is a brutal, unforced error. But that ERP disaster wasn't the only headwind in Q1, was it? The report also highlights a new macroeconomic issue impacting their costs. Tariffs.
Yes. Management explicitly flagged that changes in international trade policy are going to add a significant cost headwind this year, equal to about 1% of their total cost of goods sold.
And that hits them hard.
It directly and immediately impacts Allegion because, as we discussed earlier, a massive chunk of their manufacturing footprint, particularly the high-volume products for the residential market, is located across the border in Mexico.
Now, I want to pause here and be incredibly clear with you, the listener. The sources provided outline this tariff impact strictly as a mathematical cost reality for the business. We're not taking any political sides here.
Okay.
Whether you lean left or right on trade policy, whether you strongly support protective tariffs, or you advocate for open free trade, our job today is strictly to impartially report what the financial data says. And the data from the report states that new trade policies are increasing the hard cost to import these goods from the Mexican factories into the U.S., creating a tangible margin headwind for Allegion. Period.
That is exactly the right way to frame it. It is simply an input cost increase. Mm-hmm. Now, management claims they have enough pricing power to offset these new tariff costs entirely by raising prices on their end, distributors and customers.
But we have to see if they can actually do it.
Right. Until they actually prove they can pass those costs along without losing sales, it remains a dark cloud overhanging the stock. However, beyond the obvious headlines of the tariffs and the European ERP failure, the Q1 numbers revealed something much more subtle and arguably much more concerning beneath the surface of their prized Americas segment.
Yes, this is the specific detail that really stuck with me from the research. In the Americas segment, organic growth in Q1 was reported at positive 2.6%.
Mm-hmm.
On a headline basis, that sounds fine, right? The golden goose is still growing.
It looks okay on the surface.
But the Factors Today report digs into the actual composition of that 2.6% growth. It turns out that growth was entirely 100% driven by price increases. The actual physical volume of goods sold, the number of locks going out the door, actually declined.
When you look at the mechanics of corporate growth, this is the classic textbook signature of a maturing or slowing macroeconomic cycle.
I liken this dynamic to running on a treadmill. Imagine your stride length. The actual physical distance you cover with each step is shrinking. That is your volume. You're taking shorter and shorter steps.
Right.
To keep from falling off the back of the treadmill and crashing, you just keep cranking up the speed setting on the machine. That speed is your price increases. You just hike prices to compensate for the fact that you are selling fewer items.
It's exhausting.
It works for a little while, and you manage to stay in the same place on the treadmill, but eventually your legs just can't keep up, and you're going to trip. You fundamentally cannot rely on price hikes forever if fewer and fewer physical units are actually going out the door.
And that declining physical volume is the canary in the coal mine for the broader investment thesis. Management can go on earnings calls and claim the European ERP failure is just a transitory blip that will be fixed next quarter. They can claim they will simply price their way out of the tariff costs.
But the market doesn't buy it.
The factor models absolutely disagree.
Wait, pause. You need to unpack factor models for us. The report mentions the factor tape, and it's a really dense piece of Wall Street jargon. What exactly are we talking about here?
Factor models are essentially the massive quantitative algorithmic trading systems used by hedge funds and institutional investors.
The computer programs.
Exactly. These algorithms don't read the history of von Duprin or care about how nice a Schlage lock looks. They simply categorize thousands of stocks into different mathematical buckets or factors based on price behavior, economic sensitivity, and momentum. The algorithmic factor tape currently suggests this Q1 stumble is not an isolated event.
Uh-oh.
These quantitative models are actively pricing Allegion as if it is a company about to face a much larger systemic macroeconomic storm.
Which brings us perfectly to the master risk outlined in the report. Risk number one in the Factors Today analysis. The U.S. non-residential construction cycle is about to roll over.
To truly understand why this risk is so terrifying to the algorithms, you have to understand the physical timeline of commercial construction. Door hardware is an extreme late-stage lagging indicator. Remember earlier when we talked about how Allegion gets specified into the architectural blueprints at the very beginning of a project?
Right. The architects write von Duprin into the master plan on day one before they even dig the foundation.
Exactly. But the actual physical locks, the electronic readers, and the exit devices are among the very last things installed in the building, right before the contractor vacuums the carpets and hands over the keys to the owner.
Oh, I see.
This creates a massive time lag. It means the revenue Allegion reported in early 2026 was likely born from specifications that were written by architects back in 2024 or early 2025 during a much stronger economic period. They are currently eating off a historical backlog of old projects.
Oh, wow. So because of that lag, Allegion could be completely blind to a construction recession that is happening right now in the present day, simply because they are still busy finishing the buildings that were funded during the boom times 2 years ago.
You've hit the nail on the head. Management was incredibly vocal and optimistic on the Q1 call, confidently claiming that current specification activity remains strong, might go so far to even call it very strong.
But the data disagrees.
The broader leading market indicators suggest the exact opposite. The report specifically cites the Architecture Billings Index, or ABI. The ABI is a leading economic indicator that tracks whether architectural firms are seeing an increase or decrease in new design contracts. Currently, the ABI has been stuck stubbornly below 48. Anything below 50 signals contraction and a drying up of future construction pipelines.
Okay, so what does this all mean for the stock? We have a massive disconnect here. Management is looking at their current sales and saying things look great on the ground, but the macro data, the ABI, is flashing red, saying a severe slowdown is coming in a year or two.
It means the broader market, driven by those quantitative algorithms, has decisively chosen to believe the macro data over management's internal optimism. Let's look at how the factor tape categorizes Allegion right now.
Let's hear it.
The algorithms view it as a low beta, rate-sensitive, late-cycle building product cyclical. And crucially, the report notes it has a negative growth loading.
Again, ELI-5 on that word salad, please. Negative growth loading, low beta. What did the algorithms actually think is happening here?
Right. Low beta means the stock is generally less volatile than the overall market. Rate sensitive means its business model is highly dependent on interest rates because commercial construction obviously requires massive loans. But the key phrase is negative growth loading. That means the algorithms have mathematically stripped away any premium for future growth. The computers do not see Allegion as a high-quality compounder with a century-old moat. They see it as a generic, run-of-the-mill construction company that is about to hit a brick wall in 2027 when the old 2024 backlog finally dries up and the new orders aren't there to replace it.
If the market views this incredibly profitable 19% ROIC company as just a generic cyclical about to crash, how severely has that fear punished the actual stock price? Let's talk about the valuation paradox, because this is where the massive opportunity or the deadly trap actually lies for you as an investor.
The valuation math is the crux of the entire Factors Today report. At the time this research was published in late June 2026, the stock was trading at $139.71 per share. That price puts it at roughly 15.9 times its estimated forward earnings with a 5.7% free cash flow yield.
Which, to put in historical context for the listener, is remarkably cheap. The report specifically notes that this multiple puts Allegion in the 16.7th percentile of its own 8-year valuation history. It has rarely, if ever, been priced this cheaply over the last decade.
And to understand just how pessimistic the market is, we need to walk through the embedded expectations math outlined in the report. They use a standard Gordon growth model.
Let's break that math down so it makes complete sense. What is a Gordon growth model?
It is a financial formula used to reverse engineer what future growth rate is currently baked into a stock's price. You take the company's cost of capital, which is the rate they pay to fund their business, sitting at about 7.5%, and you subtract their current free cash flow yield, which is 5%.
Okay.
The resulting number is 2.5%.
Meaning what exactly?
Meaning that at a share price of $139, the market is pricing in the absolute expectation that Allegion will only grow its cash flows at 2.5% perpetually into the future. Essentially, the market expects them to just barely keep pace with historical inflation. The market is pricing in zero real organic volume growth.
But wait, that completely contradicts their recent history. The report explicitly states that from 2021 to 2025, Allegion compounded its earnings per share at a massive 39%. How is it mathematically possible that a company grew its underlying earnings by 39% over 4 years, but the stock price went absolutely nowhere?
It happens through a mechanism called multiple compression. As the actual dollar amount of earnings went up, the premium the market was willing to pay for each of those dollars went down in exact lockstep.
Oh, wow.
The multiple compressed from 21 times earnings a few years ago all the way down to 13 times recently. The market is giving management exactly zero credit for their historic 39% organic growth, zero credit for the $1.7 billion they just deployed into M&A to build a tech platform, and zero credit for their recently announced $500 million stock buyback program.
It is the absolute classic D-rated quality setup. I liken this to walking onto a used car lot. Imagine you are wandering the lot and you find a flawless, high-performance V12 Ferrari parked in the back.
Okay, I like this.
But you look at the sticker and the dealer has priced it exactly the same as a 10-year-old used Honda Civic.
Yeah.
You ask the dealer why it's so cheap and he says, well, I was watching the news and I heard there might be a massive citywide traffic jam next year, so no one will be able to drive fast anyway. Therefore, the Ferrari is useless. The market is pricing the Ferrari like a Civic, strictly out of fear of the macroeconomic environment.
I love that analogy, and it perfectly encapsulates the bull case for Allegion. The bulls believe the market is pricing an elite 19% ROIC monopoly that owns the local ecosystem like a cheap commodity. They believe that Ferrari is fundamentally mispriced. But the bearish investors would push back on your analogy. They would argue that if that massive traffic jam actually happens, if the commercial construction cycle truly rolls over into a recession, that Ferrari is going to sit stuck on the lot for another 3 to 4 years. If you buy it now, you're going to trap your capital in dead money waiting for a macro recovery that might take half a decade. Hence, a value trap.
So who is right? Is the market incredibly smart and forward-looking, or incredibly wrong and overly fearful? When the macroeconomic data and the company fundamentals are this violently conflicting, I always want to look at what the people inside the building are doing.
Follow the money.
Exactly.
I want to know what the executives running the company are doing with their own wallets. Do they actually believe their own optimistic hype? This brings us to the topic of governance and the intense tension between insider conviction and structural incentive flaws.
This governance section is arguably the most conflicting part of the entire research report. Let's start with the bad news, because it is significant: the executive compensation structure. We spent a lot of time earlier talking about how crucial return on invested capital, or ROIC, is for measuring Allegion's true moat and profitability.
Right. The 19% ROIC is the ultimate empirical proof that their specification lock-in actually works.
Well, what is truly baffling is that if you read through the company's proxy statement, there is absolutely no ROIC metric to be found anywhere in the executive compensation plan.
Are you kidding?
The executives do not get paid based on capital efficiency. Instead, their bonuses are tied almost entirely to revenue growth, adjusted operating income, and total shareholder return. Oh, wow. That is a massive, glaring red flag for corporate governance. Think about the behavior that incentivizes. If I am the CEO, and my multi-million-dollar annual bonus is strictly tied to getting the company bigger revenue and not on how efficiently I use the shareholders' capital to achieve that growth, what am I going to do?
You're going to buy stuff.
I'm going to go on a $1.7 billion M&A spree. I'll buy 9 software companies in one single year to artificially pump up my top-line revenue, even if paying 104% goodwill destroys the underlying return profile of the business. It classically incentivizes irresponsible empire building.
You've just perfectly articulated the bear case for management's capital allocation. It explains why they might allow that massive capital flow into the low-return international segment we discussed earlier. If your bonus only cares about top-line growth, you will buy revenue anywhere on the globe you can find it, regardless of the margin.
But there is a huge but in the report here. Just when you think management is purely empire building, the research presents the ultimate counterindicator.
Yes. Despite the deeply flawed structure of the compensation plan, the insiders are putting their own personal cash on the line in a massive way.
Oh, this is fascinating.
The CEO, John Stone, aggressively bought roughly $5 million of Allegion stock on the open market between 2022 and 2024. And it wasn't just him. Several other members of the board of directors have followed suit, buying shares with their own money in 2024, 2025, and into early 2026.
I am genuinely torn here, and I bet you listening are too. It is a massive psychological contradiction. On paper, the comp plan basically screams, buy revenue at any cost. Who cares about capital efficiency?
Right.
But in reality, the CEO is reaching into his own personal wallet, taking his own after-tax dollars to buy the stock at these suppressed multiples. Which signal do you trust? Do you trust the bad structural incentive, or do you trust the genuine multi-million-dollar personal conviction of the guy actually sitting in the corner office?
It creates a fascinating standoff. And it perfectly sets up the final debate of our analysis, the ultimate showdown between the bull case and the bear case. Let's synthesize exactly what we need to watch over the next few quarters to see who ultimately wins this tug of war.
Okay, let's lay out the bear case first. Let's explore the exact factors that would confirm this stock is indeed a value trap and that the Ferrari is going to sit on the lot forever. According to the report, if the bear scenario materializes, it drives the stock down to the $105 to $125 range.
For the bear case to become reality, risk number one has to hit with full force. The non-residential construction cycle rolls over into a true deep volume air pocket in 2027. The leading indicators like the ABI accurately predict that new architectural starts will dry up.
Okay.
Secondly, that America's organic volume metric we discussed, it stays negative. Management finds they simply cannot raise prices fast enough to mask the fact that they are physically selling fewer mechanical locks.
And the tariffs bite them.
Yes. The tariff costs leak directly into their margins because their price increases are rejected by distributors experiencing supply chain inflation. Furthermore, the international segment remains a perpetual drag. They fail to recover from the ERP disaster, and the massive Elatech RFID acquisition proves dilutive and poorly integrated.
So everything goes wrong.
In this scenario, the stock is dead money. It is a standard cyclical downturn, and the current cheap multiple is entirely justified.
But then there is the bull case. The thesis that the algorithmic factor models are just deeply, wildly wrong about the quality of this business. This scenario targets a price band of $175 to $195, basically rocketing the stock back to its all-time highs.
In the bull case, the Q1 ERP stumble truly is just a transitory one-time blip that is fixed by Q2. More importantly, non-residential construction actually holds up remarkably well because the institutional backlog projects like massive hospitals and universities, which are generally less sensitive to volatile interest rates, provides a massive multi-year cushion. Management's claim that spec activity remains strong proves entirely true.
And they successfully use their historic pricing power to offset the Mexican tariffs perfectly, protecting that beautiful 28% margin in the Americas segment.
Exactly. And crucially, the broader market wakes up. The quantitative algorithms realize they have mispriced a 19% ROIC toll bridge compounder as a generic commodity cyclical. The valuation multiple expands from 15 times back toward a more historically accurate 18 or 19 times earnings.
So we've laid out the two opposing narratives. But the brilliant thing about the Factors Today report is that it gives us something even better than just theories. It gives us the falsification test.
Real data points.
Exactly. It tells you exactly what data points will definitively prove or disprove these theories in the upcoming earnings prints. If you are tracking this stock in your portfolio, what are the exact metrics you need to look for next quarter?
There are two specific key metrics you absolutely must watch. First, America's organic volume. Not top-line revenue, not price increases, physical volume. If the volume of goods sold turns positive again, the bear case takes a massive hit. It proves the physical demand is real and sustainable.
Got it.
But if volume is negative for two consecutive quarters, the bull case is in serious trouble. The construction cycle is undeniably rolling over.
Okay, so volume tells us if the underlying demand is real. But earlier we talked about tariffs eating into their profits. Is there a specific metric to track if they are surviving that inflation?
Yes. The second metric is the segment margin trend. Watch carefully if they actually offset those tariff costs. If the Americas adjusted operating margin returns to year-over-year expansion in the second half of 2026, it proves the moat is fully intact and they possess genuine pricing power. If margins continue to compress, the bears are right.
Synthesizing all of this, the report notes that the overall mathematical skew is favorable. But it is certainly not a screaming, riskless buy. You have roughly 18% downside to the bear case and 30% upside to the bull case. It all hinges on one single, massive macroeconomic variable, the health of the U.S. commercial construction cycle.
It serves as a masterclass in how market sentiment can completely detach from underlying business quality. Allegiant is fundamentally a fantastic elite business, protected by rigid building codes, architectural specs, and a century of trusted brand equity. But in the short term, none of that matters if the quantitative factor models decide you are in the wrong macroeconomic bucket.
Which is exactly why this deep dive matters to you. Whether you are an active investor, managing a portfolio, someone running your own small business, or just someone insanely curious about how the hidden gears of the world actually work. Analyzing Allegiant teaches us how to rigorously test whether a low price tag is a genuine bargain or a dangerous trap. It teaches us to look past the blended headline numbers and dig deep into the segment data to find the truth.
And to take that a step further, it reminds us that the most impenetrable competitive moats aren't always built on flashy, cutting-edge technology. Sometimes the deepest moats in the world are built on incredibly boring, legally mandated municipal building codes and the simple logistical friction of changing a blueprint.
But I want to leave you with one final provocative thought to mull over. Something that builds on the electronic shift we explored earlier. If the future of physical access control is entirely digital, if getting into a secure commercial building is eventually just an encrypted credential in your Apple wallet talking silently to a cloud server, does the physical metal lock eventually become the least important, most commoditized part of the door?
That raises a profound question about the long-term terminal value of their mechanical moat.
Exactly. If all the real value, all the lucrative recurring revenue, and all the security intelligence moves up into the software layer, how does a 100-year-old metal-bending company ensure it isn't eventually relegated to just being the dumb iron holding the smart computer? They're aggressively buying software companies now to fight this exact future. But is it enough? Or is it too late?
It is the classic innovator's dilemma applied directly to a fire door.
It really is. So the next time you walk into a commercial building, push your weight against that heavy panic bar and hear that deeply satisfying clack of the metal lock disengaging, take a second to look down at it. You might just be touching a hidden Ferrari. Or you might be touching a 100-year-old relic desperately struggling to keep up with a smartphone in your pocket. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive.